Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we are going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever. Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
It's Marco.
Sean, we're back. New year.
It is a new year.
Same news.
And unfortunately, the same news. You up for a good fight?
Yep, I'm up for that. I had a kind of like one of those, that Groundhog Day movie where you wake up in the morning and it's like, what? Is it still 2020? And that's how I felt in the past day. But the thing is, Sean, that today we're talking about a topic that I don't think is going to go away either in 2020, 2021, or 2025. It's going to be there.
Yeah, I think our future is riddled with data and information and, unfortunately, misinformation. So,
yep.
And it's a topic we've covered a little bit with some other folks. We're going to get a different perspective today, kind of connected to cyber warfare, right?
Yeah, warfare, cyber warfare. What are the differences and what are not the differences? How it's now affecting our entire society. So, of course, I'm not an expert in that, and nor are you. And
I am actually.
You are? So am I interviewing you today?
You're interviewing me.
We have a
fantastic guest. Joking aside, we do have a fantastic guest, and that is in Chase Cunningham. Chase, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. This is one of my favorite topics to talk about, so this will be fun. And I agree with you. I think 2020 just kind of told 2021, like, hold my beer.
Exactly. Yep. I got something for you. Hang on.
We're not running out of topic to discuss, and we're actually dragging the same topic as well over and over, but with different perspective. And so glad that you can make it today. This is going to be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, and glad it's today, not yesterday. A different tone and energy, though I think we're still reeling from some of the things that have happened. But before we get any further, Chase, a few words about what you've been up to and what you're up to now.
Sure. So I'm retired Navy. It says it right there on the ball cap. I was a cryptologic technician, a retired chief, medically retired from there back in 2012, did a bunch of work for the government after that, and then transitioned my way over to Forrester Research. I was there for about 4 years. And then very recently, I've become the chief strategy officer at Ericom, focusing mainly on zero trust for organizations.
That definitely qualifies you for this conversation.
And I literally wrote the book on cyber warfare. It says it right
exactly,
there.
Exactly. I was going to say that. We were definitely fascinated by your career, your experience of what you're doing. And, you can go in many different directions, get the conversation from many different perspectives. But the fact that you wrote the book about cyber warfare, that kind of sparked a little light in my head, and that's what we're going to talk about today, but with the different approach, because this is the channel that we call the Cyber Society. So I would like to, maybe talk about how is cyber warfare affecting our entire society. And again, we have seen plenty of examples in our daily life, political life, and so forth. But maybe the best way to start is to talk with our audience and introduce the concept of warfare and how warfare became cyber warfare and how it converged. That's my assumption. You can tell me I'm wrong.
No, I mean, I think that's a good point. And you know, I like to talk in really grounded terms. So, I mean, when we talk about warfare, like, let's go back to the first two cavemen looking at each other across the meadow from each other, and somebody had something the other guy wanted, and they took it by force. I mean, that was, if I smashed your head in with a rock and I took your meat. That was, you know, warfare, you know, 0.1. And I mean, that's really what it is the imposition of will on someone else by force. You know, there's a lot of other definitions of that, but I mean, I think it's very basic thing is I will impose my will on you by force, and then I'm going to do something after that. That's what warfare really kind of boils down to if you take it all away. Cyber warfare, where we're at now, is, I mean, this is the sort of evolved practice of carefully crafted warfare tactics. And, you know, this is, you've probably heard a lot of people that will talk about, you know, warfare without firing a shot and those types of things. I mean, this is what we're getting to, is where you're able to engage at the national level, in some cases the global level, with another organization in order to gain an advantage. And you're doing it in a manner that is what would typically be against the will of that particular group of people. And you can do that now. I mean, you can do that at scale, which is where we're at. And that's kind of mind-boggling when you think about it. You know, you can have a country like North Korea, where people are so poor they have to eat grass to live, that can engage in effective warfare with a world superpower like the United States.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So a rock to the head 0.1 version of warfare, the alpha version. I don't know what the beta version of that. So I'm wondering, what version of cyber warfare are we? What's the equivalent of the rock against the head in cyber? And clearly we're well beyond that. So what's kind of the
story? Yeah, I mean, I wrote about it in my book that the first, I wrote about it and I call it the first cyber shot heard around the world, right? That was Stuxnet. And that was when it came out that the U.S. had basically caused physical damage in Iran with the centrifuges. And I mean, that was a long built, carefully crafted espionage warfare operation that caused kinetic damage. That was, I guess you would say, that was alpha, right? That was the first time. That was the equivalent of smashing the other guy's head with a rock. Now we're moving into this more carefully crafted, globally exchanged, tit for tat in cyber. Everybody talks about the Cold War. This is Cold War 2.0.
All right. So we're sitting here in the U.S. We've experienced some things inflicted upon ourselves. I'm wondering, is there anybody that's immune to cyber warfare?
I mean, if they're living in the woods in Outer Mongolia in a tent with no internet, they're immune. But other than that, not really.
No, you know, the first thing that comes in my mind when you bring the example of the rock is I'm thinking, like, back looking at the anthropology studies, where you pretty much, this is something that is, it's part of who we are, right? It's part of our psychology. And even if we have developed into some sort of a more advanced intelligent species, we're still driven by whatever kind of instinct that we had. And what is interesting too is that we just changed the methodology and the tools to apply and achieve our means, but we're still there, right? So you can put so many different level of evolution of this, but it's still inherent to who we are.
Yeah, I mean, this is imposing your will on another individual is a human thing. I mean, and it's just the level that you're willing to go through to make that imposition occur. You know, a lot of us stop at we tried and it didn't work, and we work it out and we, you know, converse and go forward. But there are instances, and there are, you know, plenty of examples of folks, you know, and organizations that decide that it's not enough, and you keep going until somebody is no longer on planet Earth.
Right. And the goal of many of the political position that we take in the warfare, it's actually to avoid war. So that's something to consider. I mean, nobody nowadays, I hope, they do actually want to go to war, because it will be a very bad consequence for everybody. But the fact is that we use these technique and tactics to put pressure and achieve maybe what we want without the need to go to launch rockets and take bayonets and swords. And
well, I would say that we're, with the capabilities that are offered in cyberspace, we're always constantly engaged in conflict. And the reason I say that is, you know, there there are no allies and there are no necessarily agreements in cyberspace of who can do what on another organization. So, you know, the U.S., everybody talks about APTs. The U.S. is an APT too. Like, we do cyber warfare operations all the time for a variety of reasons, just like China and Russia and North Korea and whoever else does. So, I mean, this is constant. If you go back to the, say, 70s and 80s when it was submarines, you know, in the ocean and you had, you know, this constant kind of back and forth going on and no one really knew about it because it was below the surface of the water. That's where we are now. This is the new, you know, never ending area of engagement for organizations. And sometimes it seems to boil over and we see a physical thing occur. But this is 24/7, 365.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, I mean, when I picture this, I get the sense that it could be far worse than what we've experienced or seen thus far. And I'm wondering how, and when we think of traditional warfare, it's kinetic, right? Something's blowing up, somebody dies. Cyber, there's an extra step before that happens, if assuming there is a connection there. How do you see the two worlds merging in that sense?
Well, I mean, we've already started to see this a little bit as far as they're becoming, you know, sort of things that work off of each other. There was an instance in 2018, I believe it was, where the Israeli intelligence organization was targeted by Hamas with basically denial of service attacks and sort of harassing cyber things. And it was enough that the Israeli forces flew a bunch of missiles over there and blew up the building where those cyber operators were working in Iran. So, I mean, it was, you know, the escalation of forces because of cyber security things taking place. And that type of thing, I think, is beginning to occur. We saw it when Russia invaded Estonia a while back. I mean, these two things are now tied together at the hip. And as we become more connected, more digitally dependent, cyber is going to become more of a force to impose that will.
Yeah. And another thing that comes to my mind, and maybe Sean, I'm stealing your question. I apologize if I do that, but the attribution, how hard it is to attribute in the end the responsibility for a cyber attack.
Yeah. I mean, attribution, I think, is extremely difficult. I wrote a lot about false flag operations and those things. And I mean, I can tell you from personal experience without going into any classified stuff that I was involved in, when you're doing these types of operations, you spend more time making sure that you cover your tracks so that it's not you that's known that you know, when you do your work. And that's something that I think we, you know, in the industry outside of the government space that's actually engaged in the conflict side of the operations, I don't know that attribution necessarily has a lot of value. I think we spend a lot of time talking about it and it's kind of nifty and cool and sexy. But I mean, in reality, we're not going to prosecute anybody. We're not going to, you know, fly a jet in and extradite them. If anything, it's going to be the military or the government that does it. So, you know, what use necessarily is it for us to say unequivocally, this was APT 28, if we're not in the government space?
Yeah. And I guess there are consequences to cyber warfare that aren't necessarily always connected to the destruction, physical destruction of something. And I think when we look at cybersecurity in general, the CIA triad, we often look at, did a system get compromised and taken down? Did data get stolen and misused? But we often forget about the availability aspect, right? Mm-hmm. Perhaps even the integrity. And clearly, cyber is things connected, banking, power grid, healthcare system, emergency services, all these different things are connected online, and therefore the availability of those, and they interact, right? The emergency support or emergency medical services are probably enabled through the internet, which is driven by power, the power grid. And so there's a connection there. So how, it may not just be a physical attack that, let's say, the bad actor or threat actor is looking to achieve. It just could be taking something offline, which could have traumatic and tremendous impact on society.
Well, and you know, the other point too is that the side of this that worries me the most is not necessarily the quick conflict, sort of shot over the bow type of physical thing. What really worries me is the long-term national implications of cyber warfare and espionage, where, you know, if you look at the Chinese strike fighter, it looks just like the U.S. F-35. And it's not because of coincidence. It's because they spent years gaining information, insight, data, configurations, all those things, and removed them and took them back to China and built the exact same thing that we had. There's a reason that the Chinese aircraft carrier looks just like our aircraft carriers. And, you know, I mean, this again, you know, the U.S., we do espionage operations as well. But the point is, like, this is long-term national level in order to gain a strategic competitive advantage over another country. And there, the short-term stuff of, you know, blowing up a building or whatever, while the loss of human life is not tolerable, like, in the grand scheme of the national cyber operations and warfare, this is huge. Like, this is a long game. It may be something we don't really know the full implications and impact of for two decades.
Yeah, I think also the impact, it's the repercussion that it has in the daily life of citizens of a country. Because if we look at past experiences and, you know, World War, the propaganda, the tentative to manipulate information, infiltrating like FM radio waves or AM radio waves and dropping publicity from airplane to make people change their mind about a certain government or so forth. It's something that we've always tried to do because information is such a powerful tool to not only, I mean, the point is the war is not just fought with arms and weapons and fists and rocks, as you said at the beginning, but it's actually, it's a psychological situation. So let's touch a little bit on how this manipulation of information, it's part of the cyber war and how it's affecting our society. And maybe what can we do to kind of prepare ourselves for something like this?
Well, I mean, I agree with you 1,000%, right? Influence is probably the most powerful weapon there is out there next to, you know, a nuclear device. I mean, influence can sway an entire nation based on, you know, how you apply it and who you get to, you know, buy off on that. And the way that you leverage influence in today's world is via social media and via interacting with the masses. And what you see, and we've seen examples of this, I won't go into it, but I mean, if you see what goes on here, if you have, you know, millions of followers and whatever else, and you craft the right stuff to go at that particular group with the right objective on the end of it, things happen. And oftentimes it may not be that it is extremely focused and exactly what the organization wanted to have happen. But in the case of warfare, like, chaos is acceptable. It's, you know, if I can just generate enough discontent, enough distrust, and enough chaos, I kind of win by default. And we've seen that. Like, there's concrete examples of it. So this age of being able to introduce and control the narrative, which controls to some degree the human response, is an evolution of the cyber warfare space.
And I'm wondering, so there's the information and the technology working together to, well, there's data and technology working together to deliver information and misinformation. What state are we in with respect to technology enabling bad things to happen, preventing bad things from happening, preparing our society and our governments and other entities to deal with this? I know, obviously, you spend a lot of time working in the field of cryptography. So communications that are encrypted, how do you get access to that to actually know if there's something going on? And obviously the misinformation thing, how do you validate that the information is accurate and from a reliable source?
Well, I mean, luckily most of the cryptography that's available in the space is pretty sound in sort of the mathematics around it. And you're able to at least say, you know, with validity, if this is encrypted, I know that it's pretty much unmodifiable piece of data, which is good. But the other issue that you run into is that encryption is also used for nefarious purposes of covering up things you don't want other people to know about. And if you really look at, you know, the network traffic analysis and the stuff that goes when people are trying to ferret out, you know, the veracity of data, They don't see all that stuff because it is encrypted. So it's a dual-edged sword. It's good to have encryption, and encryption does, you know, well with what it's supposed to be used for. However, encryption can also be used for the purposes of being clandestine in what you are trying to conceal.
And how sounds about, like, technology.
Basically, yeah, right?
I mean, helping the bad guys, and is also helping to protect ourselves. So,
and I'm picturing VPNs and even deeper, the dark web, right? What roles did those play in some of this?
I mean, those have come about from, you know, just the evolution of the space, and that's where the cyber criminal side of it goes. But there's a lot of clandestine stuff that occurs within those arenas too. And, you know, VPNs, even though they are an antiquated technology, they do a good job of being able to pipe someone directly to a resource that keeps it out of the eyes of law enforcement and everybody else.
So is technology the problem and the answer?
Or I think so. I mean, technology's, however painful that is, right? I mean, technology is not going to slow down. What we really kind of, have run into more than anything is that the human condition makes us speed to use things without thinking of all the implications. And when that happens, you wind up introducing, potentially problematic aspects of it. And that's where we kind of are now with, you know, the whole weaponization of data and everything else. I think I read a statistic somewhere that said in a given day right now, globally, we generate more information, more data than was generated in the entirety of the 20th century. And I mean, if you think about that, that is mind-boggling with the implications of what could and couldn't be modified, manipulated, and or used for, you know, nefarious purposes.
Yeah, and with that in mind, Chase, what I'd like your perspective on is all that data, right? Some of it is business, some of it's government, but a lot of it is from the citizen, right? And I'm wondering what the role society and the individual has in enabling a successful cyber attack against a particular group or even a country. And what role do they have perhaps on the other side to perhaps protect themselves, their family, their neighborhood, and beyond that?
Well, it's one of those deals where I think I think humans have proven thousands of times you can't count on people to do the right thing, unfortunately, right? I mean, people are people. We're something that can be manipulated. We're something that can be used for purposes that we wouldn't necessarily agree with if we really thought about it. So I'm hesitant to say I think that humans in society can help out a whole lot. I hope that people pay attention more and really, you know, take time to check sources and those types of deals, whatever. But I don't lose sleep trying to think that people will do that. It's just a human condition. But the other piece of it is, I think that there are technologies that are becoming available that can help in this, that can check and, you know, sort of let you know what is and isn't real, and, you know, which data is and isn't modified, those types of things. But we're nowhere near where we need to be for that volume of data yet.
Yeah, it kind of makes me go back to the beginning. And I think I always like to wrap up from when we started. So we can take this observation and talk about, again, the psychology on how these things are happening. All the manipulation we have seen in, you know, elections or Brexit and all that kind of stuff, and that applies to even simple as advertising manipulation, messages that are carved to make people change their mind and buy a product and click on something. The hope at this point, I am with you. I wish I was a little bit more positive about the human condition, but lately, I'm not really there, so I hope somebody's going to make me change my mind. And I am kind of seeing the role of technology stepping up a little bit. Although we are a big fan of Knowledge is Power and ITSP Magazine, but when it comes to these kind of things, it's really like wanted to change who we are, what is inside our gene and DNA, and it just really make me think. So I'd like to know what is your opinion on this. I mean, you started going in that direction, but, you know, maybe what do you see for the future to happen?
I think we're going to see a world where, you know, you started to see it some this year, where when things were posted on different channels and social media, whatever else, where there was a kind of an instant fact check. And if it was just blatantly, you know, fake or false, it was enough for them to say this, you know, this is flagged, which is good, because at least if nothing else, that makes somebody go, well, hang on, what's up with this? And then even if they agree with it, at least it made them take, you know, a half a second to go, you know, which is a good thing. I think we're starting to see that, and I think we'll see more of it in the future. I do think that it's also, you know, a cautious thing to be aware of, that someone or some organization could be deeming what is and isn't true or fake, which is possibly potentially problematic as well. But it's good to see that there is at least a fledgling capability that's automated to do that. And where we're going to go in the future is going to be kind of more of those things where the ability to check the reality of stuff and verify the, you know, the truth of something is going to happen a little bit faster with a little bit broader sort of scope on who is the fact checkers. But we're not there yet. But I think that this has been at least a piece of what looks like it's coming our way.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing you say, Chase, is that people have to still be involved to maybe help with some of the decisions that we're going to make. And I'm also hearing that we can't count on every individual to understand and to do, quote unquote, the right thing. Perhaps there's even questions on what the right thing is, right?
Right.
Maybe disagreement there. And so if we can't rely on technology, we can't count on the individual, do we then control the individual and a set of people, whether it's an organization or a government entity? Do we then make decisions on behalf of the individual to, quote unquote, protect them?
Well, I mean, knowledge is power, like you said. The only you know, thing now is where is that knowledge coming from? What data is it derived from? And then is that data that it's derived from, you know, accurate in its you know, use? Or is it modified or is it manipulated or whatever? I mean, we are ultimately the sum of our decisions. And, you know, what we want is to be in a place where your decisions are at least based on, you know, reality.
Yeah. Hopefully we get to make decisions still.
And that's the big question. We don't know what is reality anymore at this point. Uh-huh. I remember the early days of the internet where people were like, well, I read that on the internet. It must be true. I've read that on Facebook.
Well, it still happens now. I mean, that happens today, yeah.
Just at scale, exactly.
Yeah.
Try to go and explain, you know, the echo chamber bubbles that actually this social media have been using to manipulate for their own interest. I don't think it was a nefarious interest in terms of manipulating election or politics or anything like that. But, you know, that's how you can make a lot of money when you own and understand the information of people and use them for your own good. And again, I'm going back to the human,
keeping them engaged.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a really great study that I saw and read about where it was basically the question was, you know, how easily manipulated are people based on the crowd, right? And what these guys did was they recruited a bunch of individuals and they brought them into a room and they had four or five other folks in there and they showed them a group of lines. And within the group of lines, one line was noticeably shorter than the rest. But they basically told the folks in the room, look, no matter what, we want you to say that the shorter line is actually longer than all the others. And anyone could look at this and go, that's wrong. But what they noticed was about half of the population that they brought in, just because everybody else said that that these were the right lines to look at, that the other folks just gave in and they would just go, yeah, I think that too. And it's crazy to think that you could get half of the people to agree with something that they can see is wrong, but because the crowd says it is, they just do it anyway.
It's so much easier to follow the crowd than make your own decision, isn't it?
It is. Well, perhaps, Chase, if you think about it, you can send us a link to that study and we can share that with our folks. But also,
yeah, I can get it to you. Mm-hmm.
Also, I'd like to give you a second to maybe a quick word about your book and where folks can find that as well, because I think that it'd be very, very relevant for folks to read that.
No, thanks. Yeah, the book is Cyber Warfare, Truth, Tactics, and Strategies. It's available on Amazon and Kindle. And the sort of tagline there is strategic concepts and truths to help you and your organization survive on the battleground of cyber warfare.
Nice one.
Sounds relevant.
Certainly does. Certainly does. Well, listen, Chase, it was great connecting with you. Great chatting with you today. I appreciate your insight rooted in reality. And at least we hope it is. Right? Might be some misinformation. No,
could be. You never know. It gets much affected me too.
Exactly.
Well, again, it's part of who we are, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, trust Ian, told me no otherwise. But no, in all seriousness, I really appreciate your time and appreciate you joining us for this conversation and making it provocative. I think folks are going to think after hearing this one.
Well, that's what we hope for. And thank you guys for inviting me. This is always good stuff and super, super interesting topic area.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure there'll be plenty, unfortunately, plenty of opportunity to talk about something else that's going to happen soon. And for the audience, follow us, read the book. And if you have any thoughts and comments, you can find us on Twitter and LinkedIn and ITSBmagazine.com. So thank you very much. To the next one.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.